Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Mindscape Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Carroll. I don't want to mess around a lot at the very beginning of this one because you've probably heard of today's guest, who is Sir Roger Penrose, one of the most important and interesting thinkers and scientists of recent years, of my lifetime, that's for sure. If you don't know Sir Roger Penrose as a physicist, you might know him as a writer of popular level books, The Road to Reality, The Emperor's New Mind, and so forth. But he made his bones, as it were, in the field of general relativity, Einstein's theory of gravity. Along with Stephen Hawking, he helped invent the singularity theorems, the idea that if you get enough stuff in a region of space, general relativity says you can't help but collapsing to a point of infinite space-time curvature. But Roger Penrose has done many other things in addition to that. Just as one example, early on in the podcast, he mentions doing some early work on the nature of infinity in space-time, and what he's really referring to is the idea of a Penrose diagram, which general relativists use to make a little picture of an entire space-time. Roughly speaking, Penrose diagrams are as important for people in general relativity as Feynman diagrams are for people doing particle physics. And not only that, Roger Penrose has come up with the Penrose triangle, the Penrose process for extracting energy from black holes, Penrose tilings, twister theory, the cosmic censorship hypothesis, many other extraordinarily influential ideas in general relativity. And he doesn't stop there with general relativity. As you do know, if you're a fan of Penrose, he's been working in recent years with ideas in quantum mechanics. He has his own basically idea about how wave functions collapse in quantum theory, and the implications of those ideas for consciousness and how that relates to Gödel's theorem and artificial intelligence and all these big picture ideas. Now, in my mind, the thing about Roger Penrose is that he understands four-dimensional curved space-time better than any person alive. So that's what I chose to talk about in our conversation, mostly in this particular podcast. We do go on to other things. We talk about consciousness and quantum mechanics for the last half an hour or so. We could have talked about those for hours more, but we both had schedules to meet. Sorry about that. One thing I got to note is that we both got stuck on the names of the three people who were the authors on the papers on black hole, the laws of black hole mechanics. It's Jim Bardeen, whose name we forgot. Sorry, Jim, who wrote papers with Stephen Hawking and Brandon Carter about that topic. Now, talking to Roger Penrose, the great thing about him is he's fearless. He has enormously creative, deep ideas. Many of them have been incredibly successful and influential. Many of them are idiosyncratic. Many of them I don't agree with. You know, I didn't agree with his ideas about entropy back when I was first learning cosmology. I later realized he was completely correct in his picture of entropy in the early universe, and that had a huge impact on my career. So I'm always happy and respectful talking to Roger Penrose, whether or not I agree with his ideas. You can decide whether or not you agree or disagree with any of them in particular. What the point of the podcast is to give you information about what the ideas are. You're the one who's got to make the decision about what to think at the end of the day. So this was an extremely fun conversation. It's a great way to start off the year 2019. Let me just do two quick podcast announcements, of course. You can always support Mindscape on either Patreon or just directly through PayPal. Go to the webpage to find information about that. And like any podcaster, we love getting good reviews on iTunes and elsewhere. So we have a wonderful list of guests coming up for the rest of 2019, but I can't think of a better place to start it off than talking with Sir Roger Penrose about the nature of space-time, black holes, and cosmology. So let's go. We're all driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. You can ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites. And Mindscape listeners will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get their jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Mindscape. Just go to Indeed.com/Mindscape right now and support the show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Mindscape. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. ¶¶ Roger Penrose, welcome to the Mindscape Podcast.
Hello, great pleasure.
Now, you've not only done a lot of amazingly important scientific intellectual work, but on an amazing variety of topics. And so usually for the podcast, often for the podcast, I like to focus in on one. I have the feeling that my people will be upset if we don't hit all of the various high points of, you know, cosmology, quantum mechanics, consciousness. So, you know, we can spend 3 hours if you want, but I'm going to try to, you know, get the main things in there. But I thought starting with space-time would be a good thing to do. I mean, this is where you sort of, you know, made your bones early on. Is it safe to say the first big thing you published, the first major result, was the singularity theorem for black holes?
I think that's true. I'm trying to remember the order of which things were done. I had two PhysRev letter articles, and one was on conformal infinity, how one represents radiation, gravitational radiation, by squashing infinity down to a place where you can see it, more or less. And this is a nice way of talking about things like gravitational radiation, electromagnetic radiation, and so on. But then I wrote this article in 1965, written in 64, I think, which was about black holes, except we didn't call them then at that time. This was gravitational collapse. Going way back to work done by Chandrasekhar in the 1930s, when he was on the boat coming to England, still, I think, 19 or something, I can't remember. And he worked out that a white dwarf star would have a certain maximum mass, and if it was more than that, then it would collapse, basically.
Right, Chandrasekhar limit.
The Chandrasekhar limit, it was what was worked out at that time. The white dwarf stars being very, very concentrated, so that the mass of the sun might be concentrated in something like the size of the Earth. But these stars are certainly known, the companion of Sirius and other such stars. So it was these are things that were well established. But what Chandrasekhar showed was if the mass was above a certain amount, which was a bit more than the mass of the sun, one and a half times the mass of the sun, then there was nothing would hold it apart, and it would collapse down. And the question is, what happens to it? And Chandra was very sort of modest about this, and we're less speculating on what happens, whereas Eddington at the time was thinking, this is ridiculous, that can't happen.
Chandrasekhar got a lot of pushback, right, for this idea that there would be gravitational collapse.
Yes, indeed. He got into a lot of trouble because, well, it's a wild idea, so I'm not surprised, actually.
Yeah, you should get a little pushback.
Yes. But, of course, that didn't get down to a black hole. He just said, well, one is left speculating. I suppose he had some sort of idea that it might. Well, there's a lot of early work which people say there was this... And I forget people's names, I'm right on the spot at the moment. Anyway, there's early work where people wondered what happened to very massive objects. But until general relativity came along, there wasn't really an issue which was problematic. And it was in 1939 when Oppenheimer, of atom bomb fame, mm-hmm. and a student of his, Snyder, and they worked out an exact model, according to Einstein's general theory of relativity, of a collapsing dust cloud, and it was the picture of a black hole that we have now. But a lot of people were a bit suspicious of whether that was really what you'd expect because, well, there were two things. One is the dust cloud was material that had no pressure, and so it wouldn't push itself apart at all, and it would fall into the middle, and it wouldn't stop itself from pressure. The other point was the model was exactly spherically symmetrical. It's exactly the same all the way around, and so that the matter as it collapsed inwards would be aimed right at the central point. And so the fact that you got infinite density there was not perhaps surprising, and people thought, well, maybe if it was irregular, it would fall in and maybe swish around a bit and then come swirling out.
They thought this was an artifact, this was maybe some special thing, but it's not usually what you'd expect.
That's right. Well, I think there was argument about it. Now, I know John Wheeler was very worried about these things, and the worry came particularly to a head when Martin Schmidt, Dutch astronomer, well, Dutch-American astronomy, and he concluded that there was, well, this was the first quasar, right. And he noticed that the signals from this object, well, first of all, they were redshifted, so that meant probably it was receding from us at a very great speed, and secondly, it was extremely bright, and thirdly, it had variations in its brightness of the order of a week or so, which suggested that it couldn't be much bigger than the solar system, and that therefore you had this huge amount of energy coming out, which is something like, you know, more than the whole galaxy. And it was a real problem. And the picture which was presented was that you had something which was down at the kind of level that the, well, Oppenheimer and Schneider model would say you have a horizon at a certain point, and that this would be where this energy would be released at that sort of scale.
Sorry, this point about the variability is an important one. I like to, it's sort of not obvious to people, but it's a very simple, fun argument, right? I mean,
if
something varies rapidly, then it's probably not any bigger than it takes light to travel across the object, right?
Exactly.
And so
weak
time scales, that's the size of the solar system, which is small by, you know, massive extragalactic object standards.
That's right, yes. So it was a great puzzle, and I know Wheeler was very worried about this, and he talked to me about it, and he said, well, look, this means we've got something down at what's called the Schwarzschild radius. This was a very early solution of Einstein's equations called the Schwarzschild solution, and Schwarzschild discovered it soon after general relativity. Unfortunately, he died not long after that, but it was the first solution of could represent a body. He was thinking more in terms of a star or something, where there was something inside which was matter, and the equations changed when you get into the matter, and so that there was no singularity there. But if you imagine squashing the matter down to this radius, which is called the Schwarzschild radius, then you get into a very curious situation, which was described by the Oppenheimer-Snyder collapse model.
And then so it took a long time, right? Decades for people to really appreciate what the Schwarzschild solution was trying to tell them all along, right?
Yes.
It's a tricky little general relativity question.
That's right. Well, usually people thought there was a body inside, and so you didn't explore what happened when you extended the solution inwards. And it was the first clear, I think the Oppenheimer-Snyder model, just before the Second World War, was a first clear model of what could be happening.
Right. And then the quasars that you mentioned, I mean, so there's this bright object in the sky, very far away, very small. Seemingly, this could be a candidate for an ultra-compact object that might be what
Absolutely.
We now call a black hole. So is it really accurate to say that experimental data nudged theorists towards trying to understand this better?
Oh, absolutely true, yes. It certainly nudged me into thinking about this.
Yeah.
You know, I thought about the Schwarzschild horizon and so on and didn't think much of it as thing that might be out there. Usually one thought that if you squash the Earth down or the Sun down to that size, it would be pretty unrealistic.
Right.
But if the thing is big enough and it collapses itself inwards, and I should say that the Schwarzschild horizon, the size of it, the diameter of it, is proportional to the mass of the object. So that if the object is much, much bigger, then the volume, which goes as the mass cubed, is something which you wouldn't, the density wouldn't be so necessarily very large.
And what is the Schwarzschild radius for the Earth? I feel like it's very small number.
Tiny. I forget what it is. Something like a centimeter.
Centimeters or something,
I can't
like that.
Remember
A neutron star with the mass of the Earth would be the size of Los Angeles or something.
Something like
that.
And
a black hole is a centimeter across.
Yes,
so that's a lot of mass in a very tiny area.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. But you see, I know Wheeler was very worried about this. He said, "What happens? Do you get this singularity, or does it swish around and come out again?" And it was a big question. Should you trust the Oppenheimer model, Oppenheimer-Snyder model, or is that unrealistic because of irregularities? And at that time, I should say the quasars was around about 1962, I think. And around about that time, there was an argument by two Russians, Lifshitz and Khletnikov, and they had produced a paper which seemed to say that singularities did not happen in general circumstances.
Right.
So that when the thing collapsed, if it was a general irregular collapsing body, it would swish around, it wouldn't reach these infinite densities, infinite curvatures, it would swish round and maybe come swirling out again or something like that. So that's the picture that a lot of people had.
But you were able to prove otherwise. And what I love about it is, it, in some sense, and maybe this is exaggerating because I don't know the history very well, but in some sense, what you did represented a shift in technique in general relativity from finding exact solutions that were simple to making an absolutely general statement that just relied on the sort of intuitive powers of the theory, but made very rigorously mathematical.
No, you're absolutely right. It's just, you see, either people had found models which required a lot of ingenuity, but they had usually had some special symmetry or something like that. And these solutions, very beautiful solutions often, but whether they were realistic, well, they were all very special.
Right.
The only other way you could was to use high-power computers and work out. But then in those days, people didn't have the kind of computers we have now.
Right.
And it was pretty hard to get any impression as to what happened in the general case. So I started thinking about this. I'd been thinking about other problems a little bit like this. One of them, which I never published anywhere, was worrying about the old steady-state model.
Okay.
See, this was a cosmological model that was sort of in vogue when I was becoming a graduate student and becoming interested in general relativity in a serious way. And in Cambridge, where I was, it was a popular view.
It was a hotbed, yeah.
Yes, that the universe, although it was expanding, and the mass sort of got less and less by the expansion, the mass was replenished by hydrogen gas appearing spontaneously. And it was a very beautiful model in a way, because as the expansion took place, the matter was replenished, and you had a universe which was sort of stable, and it remained forever in this way. It had some curious properties, but the question that I was interested in is, could you in any way make this consistent with Einstein's general relativity without having to introduce negative energies and things like that? And you could see pretty well that that couldn't be the case if it was very symmetrical. But then I started wondering, well, look, suppose it's irregular in some, you know, quite serious way. Does this still cause a problem with general relativity? And I came to the conclusion, using sort of topological types of arguments, that you couldn't save it.
Is it even possible to give us, I know this is a very intricate differential topology question, I mean, but is it possible to give a flavor of the argument? It's something like gravity is always attractive, right? I mean, that's the basic principle.
That's certainly, but it was mainly how it behaved on light rays. That was the real argument. You look at how light rays behave, and it's a bit like a lens, you see. You have a parallel beam of light rays, and the way that mass acts on that is to give it focuses like a positive lens, so right. A convex lens would cause this parallel rays to focus. Now, if you have an astigmatic lens, suppose you imagine a lens which in both one direction it's positive and the other direction it's negative. I mean, don't normally find these lenses, but that's the way gravitation behaves. Mm. So if you just go through empty space, then it focuses one way in one direction and expands out in the other direction.
And this is what leads to spaghettification if you fall into the black hole.
Yes,
right?
It squashes you one way and stretches you in the other. Exactly, that's right. So that's what empty space curvature does. But the thing is, if you have combinations of lenses, it's quite interesting. You can do this just with ordinary optics. You have lenses and you put them on an optical bench, and if you had these astigmatic lenses, what you find is that if you suppose you had one and another sitting right next to it, an astigmatic lens, which is at right angles. So I mean, their planes are parallel, but the direction of the astigmatism is at right angles. Then one cancels out the other, and so it's just like a flat piece of glass. But now suppose you pull them apart, then you find there is a residual effect, which is a focusing effect. And this is connected with the energy in gravitational waves. So the gravity acts like an astigmatic lens. But when you have a lot of them one after the other, there's a net effect which is focusing as though there was matter. And this is the effect that gravitational energy has, is focusing. So I knew about these things by thinking about these focusing effects and so on. And it was using this kind of argument, together with topological arguments, that you could see if you reached a point of no return, and that was a critical point as knowing what that meant,
right,
then you would find that this focusing property would be irreversible. And you could show that there had to be some singular place inside the object that was collapsing. Really, it gets to a point where you don't know what happens. It sort of stops. Space-time gives up.
But singular doesn't just mean special. It means the curvature is getting infinitely big in some sense.
That's the expectation.
Yeah.
Although the argument that I had didn't directly show that. It just showed that there's something stopping this. The space-time comes to an end and it stops.
Right.
And the normal expectation is that it gets these focusing effects become infinite, and so things just crumple up and you can't get any further.
This episode of Mindscape is sponsored by BetterHelp. What's the first thing you would do if you had an extra hour in your day? Nap, go for a run, read a book? A lot of us ask these questions, wishing we had more time. But the question is, time for what? If you had unlimited time, how would you use it? Therapy can help you find what matters to you so you can do more of it. And if you're thinking about therapy, BetterHelp is a great way to start. What I like about BetterHelp is it's so easy to start. It's entirely online. It's convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. So learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/mindscape today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/mindscape. And you don't necessarily, it doesn't immediately follow logically that it's a black hole, right? But you had ideas about that.
Yes, that's true. But the argument that I had didn't prove it's what we call a black hole. It just showed that you had the singularity. You had to make a further assumption, which is what I call cosmic censorship,
right,
which is if the singularities in general are of the kind that you roughly speaking, can't see them, then you do get a thing that we now call a black hole. But it did depend on this cosmic censorship hypothesis.
Right, which is still not completely proven, is that correct?
I think that's correct, yes. Yeah. There's a lot of evidence that it's true, I think, in general. Well, the argument is that it has to be. You look at general situations,
yeah,
that you can cook up special examples which disagree right with it, but they're not realistic.
So the astronomers, with their data, prodded you to think about this problem, and then
absolutely,
you
yes
proved something. Did your proof prod the astronomers to take black holes more seriously?
It did eventually. It was quite interesting because you could see somehow a huge amount of skepticism about black holes. And I used to be asked to give lectures at these Texas symposia, which happened every year at first. And usually I was asked to give a talk, something about black holes. And you could see gradually people beginning to take it seriously and more, but then whoomph, it sort of went over to the other side.
Right.
It sort of happened very rapidly once enough people got used to the idea.
And then, I mean, on the theoretical side, black holes became a whole area of study, and Stephen Hawking and Brandon Carter and other people.
Yes, indeed. Yes, that's right. And Hawking's remarkable result about the fact that they do a very tiny amount of radiation. And so if you imagine in the very remote future of the universe, then these huge black holes, well, you see, now we see huge ones. Initially, there were just the odd double star system where you'd see one star and the other one, it seemed to be going around something else that you couldn't see.
Right.
But maybe there were some plane where material was coming out of it, you couldn't see the object itself. And so people speculated that was a black hole. The evidence was pretty indirect for a while. But now the evidence is, well, indirect in a sense that you don't actually see directly into the hole, but you see things like in our galaxy, we have a what we call a supermassive black hole, which is about 4 million times the mass of the sun. And it's really remarkable. You can see these pictures over so you have to speed up a little bit, but not that much. And you can see stars going around in these sort of elliptical orbits, and there's nothing in the middle.
Yeah, going around a big heavy thing that you can't see. So.
Yes, that's right.
Except it's not that big. It's a small, compact, heavy thing you can't see.
That's right. It's pretty small by the Yeah, that's right. Well, a four million solar mass. I'm not sure quite how big that is, but it's not huge.
It's less than a light year, right? Yeah, yes, it's very tiny. But so when Hawking, circa 1974, argued that black holes are not completely black, if you take quantum mechanics into account, that's they radiate. Right. How did that strike you? I mean, was that controversial at the time?
I can tell you exactly what happened. You see, I think I was away from Cambridge. So I was working in Cambridge at the time. No. Yes, it wasn't. No, when was this? That was
74, early 70s.
No, I must have been in Oxford by then. Oh.
But you and Hawking had become close and were collaborators.
Oh, yes, no, I knew him well. Yeah. But the point was I'd come back from somewhere. Exactly where, I can't remember, I haven't worked that out. But Dennis Sharma, you see, who was a great friend of mine and I learned a lot of cosmology from, and he was Stephen Hawking's supervisor. And Dennis was a great person for getting the right people to meet each other and so on, people who might benefit from encounters with other people. And he knew all the physics that was going around, so I learned an awful lot of physics from Dennis. But anyway, I come back, and Dennis told me, oh, have you heard the latest? Stephen Hawking has showed that black holes radiate, you see. And I said, what? so I got hold, I phoned him up, you see. I phoned up Stephen, and he... I said, what's this all about, you see? And he said, well, it's tied in with the ideas about thermodynamics. And I said, that makes a lot of sense. So it didn't take me long to come to the conclusion it was probably right, what he said.
Well, to be fair to the audience, you had previously shown that you could extract some energy from a rotating black hole, but a limited amount, and you had to do it sort of intentionally. It wouldn't be automatic, but that kind of, you know, pushed people on the road to think about these questions.
Yes, that's right, that you could get stuff out, in a sense. You could get energy out of it. But this was going a little further. Well, it was curious because... Now, I must have been in Oxford because I remember how this came about. We used to have these meetings every Friday in my office in Oxford with my graduate students, postdocs, and people interested. And if somebody was visiting, we'd have them to give a nice little talk. And Stephen was visiting at the time. And he was telling us about... He was imagining little black holes which might be created in the Big Bang. And the idea was, if they were rotating, would they lose their energy in the rotation? And he showed some calculation about this. And it was actually not very long after that, you see. I must have been visiting... I can't remember exactly how it was I saw Dennis at that point. But I phoned Stephen up, and it was really following up on this calculation he'd done previously about the rotating ones. And I think that he found that they didn't need to be rotating, which rather surprised
him. Every black hole does it, right?
Yes, that's right.
And I think that in the famous textbook by Kip Thorne and also Misner and Wheeler, there's this picture of an advanced civilization that has built an energy extraction device around the supermassive black hole at the center of their galaxy. There's a lot of energy we could, in principle, get out.
Absolutely.
We'd be free from our dependence on foreign oil sources if we could harness black holes this way.
Well, you see, this was the argument. I wrote a paper in an Italian journal. There was a conference in Italy somewhere, I forget where now. And there were people talking about very massive stars and so on. And I was asked to give a talk on black holes, which I did. But I'd come to this conclusion that you could extract energy. And I imagined that you could do this by having particles which would split up into two and so on. But when it came to the talk, I can't say which way around was it. I think I did give it that way around. But I thought about the civilizations rotating around the hole and extracting energy out. And it's a simple argument. You can see they could do this from quite general principles. They just lower, fill buckets full of rubbish and lower them into the hole and tip the rubbish in, and they would extract more energy than the mass of the rubbish. So it was a...
And when Hawking did explain that black holes give off radiation, this all came as part of this, as you mentioned, thermodynamics.
Yes,
right?
That's right.
Black holes have entropy.
Yes.
And there was this sort of analogy between what black holes do and the laws of thermodynamics. And this really said it's not an analogy. It's true, right?
That's
black
right.
holes have entropy.
Well, it was curious because, you see, the entropy of the black hole, it was really Bekenstein had a fairly rough argument. But I was quite... happy with that because it seemed to be very consistent that the area of the black hole should have an entropy, and that Bekenstein's argument looked pretty convincing to me. But Stephen then had a much more exact argument, and which was more impressive mathematically. But this came after a lot of discussions between Stephen and Brandon Carter and who was the other one?
I know the paper you're talking about, because the laws of black hole mechanics, but I'll tell the audience afterwards.
Yes, tell the right people. Yes, that. And there may have been, I think there were only three people doing it before.
Yeah.
But they were exploring the analogy between thermodynamics and black holes. But Stephen definitely just thought it was an analogy. I remember talking to him about this, and I was sort of thinking it was real, you see. Mm-hmm. But you see, in a way, he'd been looking more deeply into it than I had, because he realized if it was really thermodynamic, then the black holes had to have a temperature. And that didn't seem to be the case. Yeah, because they just swallow things. There's no way it can have a temperature, you see.
Right.
But then he found that they did.
I mean, I think that in A Brief History of Time, he mentioned that he was literally annoyed at Bekenstein for suggesting that the entropy was real, and that motivated him to do this.
That's interesting. I hadn't quite realized it was that argument, but that's right.
Did that help get you interested in entropy? Because it was just a few years after that you started talking about the entropy of the early universe.
It must have done. I'd have to try and put it together. But to be able to assign a value to this entropy, that was crucial for that, right. You see. I can't quite remember the order of my thinking here, but a big, certainly something which I played around with a lot was thinking about, well, I thought about it in the steady state model. You see, you have the issue of entropy balance troubled me, you see. But there, you see, you had this creation of the hydrogen, which the fact that it was could condense, you see, and form objects could be a source of the entropy. And so, a source of low entropy, I should say, a reservoir of low entropy. So that's how it sort of squared itself in my mind with the second law issue. I've been worrying about it then already. But when that had to be given up and one was looking at models which expanded and didn't have creation of matter, at some point I was worrying about this question, but it didn't really have substance to it until the Hawking... Bekenstein-Hawking entropy value for black holes and how huge it was.
Yeah, so just I need to be very fair to all of the audience listeners. Entropy, they've heard the word before, but it's roughly speaking a measure of how random, disorganized a certain system is.
Sure.
And in some sense, intuitively, you might have thought that a black hole has zero entropy. It's not a lot of different ways a black hole can be, right? It's not like a cup of coffee where there's a lot of arrangements of the atoms inside. But Hawking and Bekenstein show that it's actually a huge number. And that inspired you in some sense to start writing about... the second law of the thermodynamics says that entropy tends to increase in closed systems, and therefore it's not surprising that entropy used to be lower in the past.
That's right.
But cosmologists have a long history of being confused about this issue.
And, yes, they have.
And I think that, let's just be honest, that this is the most profound, and it's been quite a profound effect that you have had on my career, because it was your papers emphasizing this problem of why the early universe had such a low entropy, which I thought were completely convincing, and puzzled by why my fellow cosmologists don't take this seriously. So Why don't you explain how you think about it?
No, you were one of the few people who really latched onto it immediately. But I was just as puzzled why people didn't take it seriously. But the basic argument is this, as you say, I mean, the entropy, or the randomness, if you like, increases with time, and that's the second law. Another way of saying exactly the same thing is, if you go back in time, it decreases. So as you go back and back and back in time, you should find the entropy very small. Now, what's the earliest evidence that we directly see of the universe's state? That's the cosmic microwave background. So this is radiation coming from all directions, electromagnetic radiation. And this radiation has a lot of entropy in it, but the main point that I'm going to sort of concentrate on here is, if you look at the curve which represents the intensity for different frequencies, you have this thing, the curve goes up and then comes down again. And it's what's called a Planck curve.
The amount of light at different wavelengths.
That's right. Yeah. So there's a certain temperature where it's maximum, and then the radiation at higher frequencies it goes down. And this Planck curve is observed, the COBE satellite, when it went up. You'll have to tell me the dates, I don't remember.
1991, 92, yeah.
Okay. The COBE satellite measured this curve of this, the intensity for different frequencies of this radiation, have found an extremely good fit, an almost perfect fit to the Planck spectrum. What does the Planck spectrum tell us? It tells us what we're looking at is maximum entropy. I mean, that's the whole point of it. It's what they call the black body radiation, which meant maximum entropy. So here, this is what I call the mammoth in the room. I mean, you go back and back in time where the entropy is supposed to be going down and down and down until it reaches a maximum, which is sort of the wrong way around. Right. And I don't know why people didn't worry about that more. But the point is, the answer, I think partly because it's muddled up with the expansion of the universe, that people sort of think, oh, well, the universe is expanding, and so maybe there's not much room for entropy down there or something like that.
I think it's partly that, and partly that when we're taught thermodynamics, gravity is not a part of it, right? We
yes.
don't think about I think black
that's
holes
right,
and so
yes.
forth.
I mean, there were people like Tolman, one of the early mathematical physicists who studied cosmology, and he understood pretty well about the entropy issue. So people certainly did understand it, the right people at that time. But anyway, yeah, you got this huge amount of entropy in the radiation, which is a lot, actually. And then why is this, does that second law hold when it starts off at the top? And it's got nowhere to go, if you like. And you could have to convince yourself that the expansion of the universe doesn't help, which is the point Tolman did understand. But the other issue, you see, you've got this radiation coming from all directions in which it has this thermal character. But the other point about it is it's also very uniform. So it's almost completely uniform over the whole sky. If you take account of the Earth's motion through the radiation, it is uniform over the sky to about one part in 100,000. So it's really pretty uniform. Now, you see, what does that indicate? You say, well, okay, suppose you have a gas in a box, then the temperature would be pretty uniform if it's at a maximum entropy state. You just leave it in the box, and the temperature, apart from gravity and all that stuff, it would be uniform temperature. So that also represents high entropy. So where is it low? Well, it's low if you think of not a gas in a box, but suppose you think of a huge box of galactic scale, and it's got stars running around in it. Now, those stars will tend to clump because of their gravitational attraction, and eventually become black holes. And as they do this, the entropy goes shooting up, particularly with the black holes, because, as we know from Bekenstein and Hawking, the entropy is absolutely enormous. So that represents an increase in entropy. So you have these two things about the early universe. One is the Planck spectrum, which tells you that the matter and radiation. You see, the Planck spectrum is telling you that the early stage of the universe, photons and matter were kind of at maximum and randomized as much as they could be. And so that radiation comes to us and you see this Planck spectrum. But the other feature about it is that it's uniform, and that, as far as gravity is concerned, is very low entropy. Because as things start to clump, and a good example of this is our sun. Mm-hmm. See, our sun used to be a long time ago, a distribution of gas all over the place. And it went through various stages, but it clumped together and produced this hot body. It would be hot even if there were no thermonuclear reactions at all. So it gets that heat, which is, when compared to the darkness of the background sky, is a very low entropy situation. You can get energy out of it by simply...
And we do.
We do, absolutely. That's why we're here. The plants do by photosynthesis, and we live off plants and animals that eat plants and so on. And so that's where it all comes from. So it comes from the fact that the sun is a hot spot in a cold background sky. And this is why we are interested in the second law of thermodynamics, because it's low and it's creeping up is what we get our structure from and all that stuff.
So ultimately, the cosmic microwave background, it looks like it's maximum entropy, but that's only because you forgot that there could have been all these lumpinesses, which would have made the entropy much lower. Like, I think it's true. Yeah. The entropy of the black hole at the center of our galaxy is larger than the entire entropy of the cosmic microwave background.
That could well be, yes. And if you look at it, thinking all the stars, all the galaxies that are around, it's absolutely enormous. Like the entropy in the black holes is absolutely stupendous by comparison with anything else.
So this is very good news for the second law of thermodynamics. It explains that the early universe had a low entropy, actually, not a maximum entropy.
That's right.
It's bad news for cosmology because we're stuck with this question of why the early universe is like that.
Exactly.
A lot of cosmologists like the theory of inflation proposed by Alan Guth around 1980, and you were one of the first gadflies there saying that inflation is a bit of a cheat, I think.
Yes. Well, you see, I thought this is a crazy idea. It won't last a week. And how wrong I was. No, I was completely wrong. It just seemed to me such an artificial theory. You had to invent a special field. Well, in the old days, they called it a Higgs field because they hoped that the Higgs field would be the same as the... But that didn't work.
Want to know one of my favorite sounds? Here it is. That's the sound I hear when I'm learning a new language with Babbel. And if you want to learn a new language this year, I guarantee it'll be one of your favorite sounds too. Babbel is the science-based language learning app that actually works. Babbel is designed by real people for real conversations in a series of quick 10-minute lessons that are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. I'm going to be traveling to France for the first time in a long time very soon, and Babbel's helped me reconnect with how to speak to merchants, how to order food, without having to consult a language app. Here's a special limited-time deal for Mindscape listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners, at babbel.com/mindscape. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/mindscape, spelled BABBEL.com/mindscape. Rules and restrictions may apply.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
We should explain that the basic idea is that the universe underwent in very, very early times a period of super fast accelerated expansion, which I think you would agree. It's true that if that happened and if the energy driving that expansion turned into matter and radiation, it would give you a universe looking like our universe. But it doesn't help explain the initial conditions.
It doesn't, because you've got to have it pretty uniform already. Otherwise, it doesn't even work.
Right.
So it's you can have quite general arguments to show that it can't really be the explanation of the low, not just the low entropy in the early universe, but this particular form that it's low, namely in gravitational degrees of freedom.
Right.
And it just struck me strange why cosmologists, you know, you can see a list of what are the problems of cosmology, and you look down the list and say, where is this?
I'm totally on your side there. But so both of us are, you know, in the small band of people who've been trying to invent models of the universe, which naturally explain this early entropy. But that's where we diverge. So I think that inflation, I would honestly give it a 50% chance part of the final answer.
That's a lot more than I'm giving it.
Exactly, but a lot lower than all my friends give it, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Professional cosmologists.
You're right.
So, and you've been working very recently on a new model of the universe on its super largest scales.
That's right. Well, recently isn't even all that recently. It's over 10 years anyway.
Okay.
But nobody paid. It took me a long time to... I used to lecture about... let me explain the model first.
Please.
The argument is that... think of the two ends of the universe. We have this future which seems to be dominated by this exponential expansion. So this is observations of supernova stars and other things together, which persuaded cosmologists enough to give... the two groups the Nobel Prize, which was very deserved, to see that the universe is having this, what's called an exponential expansion. It's a sort of self-similar. The rate of expansion is proportional to the size and so on. So it's something which seems to be taking place. Now, Those of us who were brought up on cosmology and read the cosmology books would have seen that these kinds of models with that exponential expansion are perfectly well described in the books. These are models in which there is a thing called the cosmological constant, which is positive. And it's usually referred to as a lambda, capital lambda, so it's like a V upside down.
Right. Basically the energy of empty space.
Well, you can think of it as energy. People call it dark energy, yes, right. Yes. I'm not sure I'm happy with that term, but never mind. That's it's certainly well explained by this, excuse me, by this Einstein cosmological constant. Einstein introduced this term in 1917, for what was the wrong reason. He wanted a model which was static. He hoped that the universe was static. I think it's a sort of appealing idea. The steady state model is, again, the same sort of appeal, philosophically appealing in some way.
To be fair, I think it was also the observations at the time. The universe looked static to astronomers in 1917.
I guess Hubble hadn't quite...
Right, that was 1920s.
It was after the Vesto-Slipher, wasn't it? Because Vesto-Slipher had already seen the expansion. Maybe it wasn't such a convincing argument.
You saw that there were objects that were moving away from us.
Yes,
I guess you didn't know if they were far away.
I guess that's true. It probably wasn't terribly persuasive, but there was some indication, but not enough to rule out a model like Einstein, the one he produced then. But for that model, he needed this term. And it's the only thing you can really do to Einstein's equations without wrecking them, in my view. Mm-hmm. You just add this term, and he didn't like to do this at first, but then I guess he thought, well, let's put it in, and then you get a static model, which we refer to as the Einstein cosmology. But then, not long after that, Hubble showed pretty convincingly that there was this expansion in proportion to the distance, so the whole universe seemed to be taking part in this expansion. And so Einstein, I guess, kicking himself for not having stuck to his original equations, which seemed to indicate he would have predicted it.
He could have become famous, yeah.
Yeah, he could have become famous, yes. Well, he considered this to be his greatest blunder. And I think that's true. It's on record. I think Gamow has recorded Einstein having said this. So, this is... but it's all in the cosmology books, despite Einstein sort of retracting it. And people study it. I studied it. I studied, looked to see what the infinity looked like in this model and so on. So I was familiar with it, although I was a bit slow on the uptake to taking it seriously. I think it was Jerry Ostreicher who told me, I said, well, you know, maybe these distant supernovae look red because of dust and so on, which people thought maybe was the case. And he said, oh, no, there are all sorts of other things. It's got you. Yeah. It's not just that. You have to take it seriously. So I thought, okay, I'll take it seriously. And it wasn't, I don't know how long after that conversation, that I began to think about the remote future. Now, you see, the remote future, and I mean the very remote future, we have... The universe expands and expands and expands, and it gets more and more rarefied, and nothing much happens. You get sort of dead stars, and it gets pretty boring. And the most exciting things are around these black holes. But they're pretty boring, too. You sit around waiting for it to evaporate, according to Hawking's evaporation. And for the big ones, it takes about a Google years, something like that. So you're thinking about 10 to the 100 years, one with 100 zeros, that number of years.
Wait.
Yes. And that's an awful long time. So I regard that as a pretty boring area. We'll wait for that. But then, you see, after it's gone off pop by Hawking evaporation, now that's the very boring era.
Not even black holes. Yes.
That's right. I mean, I couldn't think of anything more boring than that. And I admit this is an emotional argument, but it just seemed to me, for our universe, that's it, you see. It's forever and ever, just eternal tedium. You see?
Well, it is weird, and I think that cosmologists underemphasize how weird it is. We always talk about the last 14 billion years of the history of the universe, because that's the past, that's what we've observed, and we say it's a long time and so forth, but our best current models say we have infinity years toward the future,
which is
a rather big imbalance.
Interminable boredom, yes. Well, you see, then I began to think, well, who's going to be around to be bored by this? And I thought, well, pretty well photons. And it's damn hard to bore a photon. That's actually, I don't expect it to have actual experiences, so boring is perhaps not an appropriate term.
Again, to be fair, I did interview David Chalmers on the podcast, and he thinks that photons can have actual experiences, just a little bit. So maybe, you know, let's think about the photon's feelings here. Let's take those into account.
Okay, well, that helps me a little, because they still don't get bored. They don't get bored because if you take relativity, now this is ordinary old-fashioned special relativity without the curved space-time and all that, it doesn't matter curved or not. The photon, because it travels with the speed of light, the time is just stretched out and it's nothing. So right from any from its creation in some particle decay or something, this photon goes out to infinity. And it experiences zero time. So it's not bored in the sense of forget about whether it actually has feelings or not. It doesn't experience the passage of time. Now, this is the sort of thing I used to play around with when thinking about gravitational radiation and how you put boundaries on space-times and so on. And it was a useful way to think that this boundary is something you could imagine going through. And if you were a massless thing, when you hit that boundary, you say, well, where the hell am I, you see? There's got to be something on the other side, you might think. I mean, it's only a way of thinking. I didn't think of it seriously that way.
So okay, let's just, I think, just to get this correct in people's minds, this is a boundary that we're talking about that is literally infinitely far away, but you're saying the photon experiences zero time, so it gets there.
That's exactly right. But I think it's very useful if you have seen these pictures by the Dutch artist M.C. Escher. There's a very famous one with angels and devils, and they, in the middle, you can see the angels and devils interlocking, and then you go out, there's a circular boundary, and they seem to get smaller and smaller and smaller, and they crowd in on that boundary. Now, this is a representation of a kind of geometry, which is called a hyperbolic geometry, and if you think of those angels as really all being the same size as each other and the devils all the same size, then although it looks to us as though they get smaller and smaller, to them, they're all the same size.
And did you have something to do with inspiring that Escher?
No, that was my relation to Escher was something a little different. But that was Coxeter. It was the same meeting, yes. Yeah, this was in the International Congress of Mathematicians in whenever it was, early 50s, I think.
Okay.
And it was the mathematician Coxeter who wrote to Escher and said, well, you might find this interesting to explore, you see. So no, that was amazing.
So it's a representation. It's in the spirit of what you did for space-time and general relativity, where you can express infinitely far away things in a finite piece of paper.
Exactly. That's what it is. And the thing about this, the Escher picture, is it's what's called conformal. So that means that small shapes are accurately described. They're squashed down. You look at the eye of the devil, if you like. It's got a certain shape. And no matter how close to the edge you get, it retains that shape. It's smaller, so it's squashed in one direction and equally well in all other directions. So it's what's called a conformal representation. So it's a conformal picture of an infinite universe, but where you see infinity as a finite place. Now, you can use the same trick in cosmology. But then you're thinking of space-time and not space. And what conformal means is that you preserve the speed of light, if you like. The thing's called the light cones, which tell you how speed of light goes, or how light goes. And so this squashing down of infinity, if you are light, you don't notice the difference. In fact, it's a more general thing. It's if you don't have any mass, you don't notice the difference.
If you move at the speed of light.
At the speed of light. And it's also a factor, not thinking of particles, but of fields, and the electromagnetic field, which light is is a feature of electromagnetic field. This is Maxwell's famous equations. And these equations of Maxwell, again, are insensitive to the scale. So you can squash and stretch as long as you do it equally in both directions. And in space-time, that means you squash the time and the space equally. Then that kind of transformation is not noticed by light or not noticed by the Maxwell equations.
Right.
And that's true also of the Yang-Mills equations of particle physics and nuclear physics.
So these are the nuclear forces, the strong nuclear forces.
They all have this, except for mass. So you've got to be careful. You've got to get rid of things which may disturb the conformal. Right. But the equations themselves, classical equations, are completely insensitive to the scale. So anything which doesn't have mass, that boundary which we've just drawn, is just like anywhere else. Now, that's infinity, you see. Well, it's not quite, because we have to worry about the black holes. But the black holes eventually decay away, you see, so we got rid of them too, you see. But the other end, you say, well, what's the excuse for stretching out the Big Bang to make it look similar? Now, the excuse there is not an excuse, because most Big Bangs don't work.
Wait, sorry, I think that we skipped a step, or I just wasn't paying close attention. But you've been explaining the future, and it has certain nice, remarkable mathematical properties.
Yeah.
And your move is to relate it to the past, right? To say, like, that's actually right. The very past of the universe kind of looks similar. Maybe we can make some money off of that.
Exactly, that's right. No, you can use a similar trick, but the opposite way around. So in the future, you have to squash it down. So you like the Escher picture.
Right.
In the past, I was trying to find an Escher picture which did it for the... Yeah. It didn't quite. There are some which almost do it. But if you go into the past, you can stretch it out. Now, all the standard cosmologies, the ones that Friedman and Lemaître and Robertson Walker, the cosmologists, the models that most cosmologists play with, do have the property that you can stretch out the Big Bang in those models to make it nice and smooth. But almost all models, if you think of what possible things there can be in Einstein's equations, they're a great mess at the beginning, right. And they don't have a nice, smooth Big Bang. But those ones which do have a nice, smooth Big Bang are ones that you can stretch out and make it a nice conformal boundary, and those are the ones which you could say that the gravitational degrees of freedom are killed off right at the beginning. So you have a nice picture with the entropy low in gravity but not low in anything else, and so that's being able to do that trick is seems consistent with what we seem to see of the universe. And my former student and colleague Paul Todd used this as a criterion for the kinds of Big Bangs that one might be interested in, that you can stretch them out in this conformal way. Now, you see, what's the argument here? You want to say, in the future, it's because you've got massless things around. In the past, well, you see, the argument is sort of similar, but not quite the same. There you have very, very large temperatures, get hotter and hotter the closer you get into the Big Bang. That means the more and more energetic the particles are. And when they get very energetic in the sense of their motions, kinetic energy, and that completely swamps the masses.
They're effectively massless.
Yeah, so they're effectively massless. So really, around the Big Bang, everything is pretty well massless. So it's sort of reasonable physically to do these tricks at both ends.
So what you're suggesting, what you've called it, is a conformal cyclic cosmology.
Yeah.
You think our universe has an infinite number, presumably, of cycles,
yeah,
where you go
well.
From Big Bang to stuff like us to the future and then repeats.
Yes, well, the idea is that our Big Bang was the conformal infinity of a previous eon. I call it an eon. I like not to call our universe, because we're all entangled with each other and it's a part of one big thing. So our eon, A-E-O-N, I like to think of it as, began with the Big Bang and ends, in a sense, with its squashed off infinity. But if you apply the stretching at the beginning and the squashing in the future, you get a thing which looks a bit like a cylinder, and you can imagine that joining on to another tube, which was the previous eon. So its remote future conformally, smoothly fits onto our Big Bang.
And one of the exciting aspects is it might be observationally testable.
Absolutely. Well, there are some new features on this. At first, I used to give lectures about this and said, this is fun, and I can go on talking about this, and nobody will ever prove me wrong, because we won't have any way of seeing whether it's right or not. But then I started having an idea. Maybe one could see a test. And so the first thing I thought of was, what about black hole collisions? You see, our galaxy has a supermassive black hole in its center, so it's 4 million times the mass of the Sun. I think the Andromeda galaxy is about 20 times bigger or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we are on a collision course with it. Not very near in the future, but you have to...
We're thinking big here. It's
yes,
professional
that's right.
Cosmology.
But eventually, these black holes will the galaxies collide and the black holes will feel each other out. It'll take a while. Finally spiral into each other and there will be one whacking explosion, which will carry away a significant proportion of the rest mass of the combined black holes. And that will be gravitational radiation primarily, like the LIGO detection of the black holes and that we've seen and very proud of. And now this is a far, far bigger explosion.
Right.
We might be lucky to see such a thing in a very distant future. I don't know. Anyway, this explosion would carry out to the crossover between one eon and the next. And you have to look at the equations now. You see, you need equations to do the gluing job from one to the next. And okay, you can produce equations which have nice behavior. And they indeed kill off the gravitational degrees of freedom, but they don't kill it off. I mean, the degrees of freedom survive, but not as gravitational waves. They come through as disturbances in the newly created dark matter. So you have to have, to make the equations work, you have to have, we talked about dark energy, but this is dark matter. And that seems to be some real substance out there. But in this theory, it's got to be there. It's got to be where the degrees of freedom of the gravitational waves get picked up and translated into this form on the other side. And these would produce signals that could be seen. They would look like circular features, maybe concentric ones, because in a cluster of galaxy, you know, there'd be a lot of battles between black holes swallowing each other up and then end up with one big whacking one in the middle of a cluster. And that's the one that finally you get.
Yeah.
That's right. But there are claims and arguments about whether we see these rings. I think the most persuasive argument was from my Polish colleagues. They had a first looking at the WMAP satellite. And then the later satellite is this Planck satellite, which did some very, very precise measurements of cosmic microwave background radiation. And they claim to see signals of this nature with a confidence level, this is looking at the Planck data, with a confidence level of 99.4%. Nevertheless, people don't pay any attention.
I mean, have they argued against it, or are they just passing by in silence?
It's very strange because they had a lot of trouble with referees who said, "Look, you've got to do this, and then we don't believe you. You've got to do this test, that test." They did them all. The polls were absolutely. This is Christoph Meissner and Pavel Mirovsky, and it's Daniel Ahn, who was a Korean who did the analysis in that case, and they. In the Planck data one, they came to this conclusion, 99.4% confidence, using all the tests. But the editor said, more or less, "Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to accept your paper, you see, despite all the complaints people had.
Right.
But you should say in the initial part of the paper, this might be a chance effect."
It's always possible, yeah.
It could be a chance effect.
But the good news is, you know, it's in the data. The data hopefully will improve. You've made a prediction. People will figure out one way or the other.
But what's more exciting is what's happened more recently.
Okay.
You see, this is the same, more or less the same team, the Polish team with Daniel Ahn, and they were doing a slightly more sophisticated analysis, which came from a discussion I'd had with Christoph Meissner. You know, maybe you could refine the signals and see what the shapes of them are and so on. And they then found a particularly strong signal for some very small ring-like structures. And this was puzzling to me at first because it should be... I saw some evidence for the bigger ones, but it didn't seem nearly so impressive as the small ones. But then it occurred to me that I had thought about this before, but I'd not really dared think about it seriously, which is the question of what happens to these supermassive black holes. See, any cluster will end up with a big, whopping great black hole in its center.
Mm-hmm.
This will gradually decay over something like a 10 to the 100 years, Google years.
I mean, sorry, in fact, any cluster turns into a whopping big black hole.
Pretty well, right? Yes. Yeah. I think pretty well all the matter gets swallowed. I don't know exactly what proportion it is, but you would expect, I would guess, pretty well, most pretty well all the matter gets swallowed up. So you've got this black hole sitting there, and it sits there, and eventually it decays away by Hawking evaporation. Now, you see, Hawking evaporation is very cold, most of it, and it, you know, could pretty well ignore it. Enormously long wavelength, and ignore it. But as a total, it carries away the entire mass of that supermassive black hole. And where does that mass go? Well, you think, go think about the Escher picture again. You see, you have an event which is taking place right up near the edge of that boundary. And that means all the radiation which comes out is concentrated right at one little point. So you would have, according to this Skitt theory, what I refer to as a Hawking point. You see, it's a Hawking evaporation. And these Hawking points would be a release of an enormous amount of energy right at that point. And then it would spread out through about 380,000 years, which is the time between the Big Bang and the last scattering surface where you see the microwave background. And the amount it spreads out is to, well, 4 degrees, which is about 8 times the diameter of the moon. So it looks quite a sizable thing, but pretty small on the basis of looking at the whole sky. So you'd imagine spots of that size. Now, we wouldn't see them quite that size because our past light cone only cuts through a bit of it. So that's a little technical point. But they're comparable that size. Like maybe, say, 5 times the diameter of the moon or something like that. But this is just the scale in which the latest analysis you seem to see an effect. And this would be regions where, I mean, they look at rings, and you imagine this ring surrounding the Hawking point, and in the middle it's hot, and then it cools down as you get towards the edge of the ring, as the energy gets dispersed through this this period of time from the Big Bang to the 380,000 years. And that spread, you can see it's concentrated in the middle and spreads out, and it's completely consistent with that.
Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
And now the latest thing, which is just about, I think, now on the archive, the latest version of this article, is we give a confidence level from the looking at simulations and things of 99.98% confidence. Now, this is just clearly out there in the data. Anybody something else can look. They can, and if they see something else, well, we'll have to see why we all see a different thing. But the evidence seems to be out there, and it has this confidence level is clearly calculated of 99.98%. Now, one of the real problems for inflation of this, you see, is that the point you would be seeing, not the Big Bang in inflation, would be what's called the graceful exit moment. So inflation, in the inflationary model, it started very close to the Big Bang, and then this huge expansion took place. And most things which happen in that region of this huge inflationary expansion would be spread out to an enormous size. So only at the very end would you get something which is restricted to this 4 degrees across the sky. And we don't see the signal bigger than that. That's right. The size of it. So if people come around and say, yes, they see the same signal we do, and I don't see why they can't do that, then they would say, well, how is this an inflationary effect? If it's due to inflation, it would be how something which just happened at the last minute. Just as inflation turned off at this point, well, they have a lot of trouble with anyway, called it graceful exit. That was one of the reasons I had trouble believing in it, how you turn the blasted thing off uniformly over the whole universe, which seems a great problem. And more of a problem now, because it's not just uniform. You've got odd little points where there's a huge amount of energy spewing out. And I'm waiting to see what the inflationary explanation will be for these things.
But the good news is, there, you know, we're talking about data now. We're talking about observations. Other people can repeat the analysis,
absolutely,
and we'll see what comes out of that. Good. And you've written a book about the conformal cyclic cosmology.
I wrote a book, yes. It was. I talked a little about the black hole collision, but nobody'd seen them at that point. I didn't make any particular point about observation, just that it potentially was possible.
I do want to, you know, plug the books. This is part of a important part of appearing on. That's your reward for appearing on the podcast.
But yes. Cycles of Time is the title.
Cycles of Time, excellent, good, yes. Available wherever you books are available. Yes. But it's not the only book you've written. You've been very happy to go and write books about all sorts of topics. I think that people are going to want to hear about quantum mechanics.
Oh, yeah.
If that's okay. I think we've talked about quantum mechanics on the podcast before. Certainly we will going forward. There's the measurement problem.
Absolutely.
Quantum mechanics has this weird feature that there seems to be a thing that we need to include in the description that is what happens when you look at something, unlike any other theory ever in physics.
Yes.
And so, like many people, you've been dissatisfied by the standard approaches to this problem. So how do you like to think about it?
Well, I take the view that quantum mechanics is not finished. I mean, I don't like to quote authority, but actually I do, because
when they're right.
I mean, Einstein was always he was doubtful about the theory being a complete description of what goes on, and Schrödinger, you know, put forward the equation which quantum theory is supposed to satisfy. Well, he was troubled with it, you can see, because he put forward this ridiculous situation of the cat, which is a superposition of light and death, as an example of the absurdity of following his own equation.
Exactly.
So he was not saying, look, this is what happens. He's saying, this is an absurd thing. We don't understand what's going on.
And that doesn't mean that they're right, but if those people were worried, then we have a license to be worried a little bit.
That's right. Well, Dirac also, you have to find the right quote there, because he didn't express himself very much. But if you find the right place, he was also just as skeptical.
I didn't know that. I knew about Einstein and Schrödinger.
That's less well known. But he regarded quantum mechanics as a provisional theory.
Mm-hmm.
It works very well, but we need something better. I'm not sure how explicit he was about what it is that's worrying him, and maybe it was divergences as well, but I think it was probably the measurement issue.
There's a wonderful book by Adam Becker called What is Real that just came out, which makes the case that we tell ourselves this false story about Einstein and Bohr, where Einstein just couldn't keep up and Bohr got it right. But in fact, Einstein, you know, his arguments were better, but he lost the PR battle back in the day.
Yeah, it seemed to be that, yes. Well, it's quite curious because, in my view, he was thinking on the right lines, because he was bringing in gravitational effects. And Bohr, at this particular case, saw a way of resolving the issue in favor of the conventional view. But that was because they never really considered the effect of gravity on things. It was the effect in gravity. And it's when you think of the effect of gravity, that's where things change. At least that's my view. And you can make, a good argument that there is a basic contradiction between the basic principles of both theories. Now, when I say the basic principles, in GR, general relativity, this is the principle of equivalence. That is to say, a gravitational field is like an acceleration. So if you fall freely in a uniform field, the gravitational field is gone, as far as the physics is concerned.
Right.
And the principle in quantum mechanics, which I'm concerned with here, is the principle of superposition, which it says if you have an object which can be in one place, and if it can be in another place, then there are perfectly good states where it's in both places at once. You can see this with neutrons and things. That's the way things behave. But when it comes to cricket balls or baseballs, that's not what you see. And the question is, why? What's the difference? And it's curious because I went to lectures when I was in Cambridge doing. I was just working on pure mathematics, but I went to lectures on various things that interested me, like cosmology and general relativity by Bondi, of course on mathematical logic by a man called Steen, about Gödel's theorem and Turing machines and things. And then there was a lecture by Dirac, and I think it was his first lecture, where he talked about the superposition principle, and he had a piece of chalk, and I think he broke it in two as an image of where it could be in two places at once. And he talked about it, and my mind wandered for a bit, and I don't know what I was thinking about. And when it came back to the subject, he'd moved on. And I remember him saying something about energy. I wasn't quite sure what. I think it's just as well I didn't hear his explanation, because it might have calmed me down.
And
instead, I worried about this forever ever since. So how is it that big, massive bodies don't appear in two places at once? But then you see, if you look at the principle of... I have an example about this. You think of an experiment done on a tabletop which involves the Earth's gravitational field, and you can treat it two different ways. Either the sort of Newtonian way, which is a standard quantum mechanics procedure, putting what's called a term in the Hamiltonian, don't worry about what that means, but it's what they do.
Right.
And the Einsteinian way, which would be, no, you pretend that you take a freely falling frame and there isn't a gravitational field. And then you compare the answers. You have a thing called the wave function in each case, and the two calculations are almost the same. If you look at them carefully, whether they differ by what's called a phase factor, which you usually don't care about. And so if you stuck to one... if you look at them carefully, you see that this thing called a phase factor actually has a little awkward thing with the time cubed in it, which tells you that actually what's called the vacuum... See, when you do quantum field theory, you have to... There's a thing you have to do, you have to settle on what the vacuum is. And then
the vacuum
you,
is an interesting place in quantum field theory.
Yes, exactly. And what you find is that the vacuum is different in these two approaches. Now, this might not matter because you say stick to one and you're fine. But now think of a different situation where you've got an experiment where it's not the Earth's field. You can forget about that because it sort of cancels out. But the main point is that the Einsteinian point of view, when you have this superposition, if you look at what a little bug would feel near the superposed lump, it's got one vacuum for one position and the other vacuum from the other, and you're stuck. Because in standard quantum mechanics, you can't form these superpositions when it's different vacuum. So what I do is to sort of say, okay, well, let's go through as best we can and see if there's a kind of error that you could attribute. It's not quite right, but how far off are you?
And so, sorry, just to conceptualize this, it's because the gravitational field of the thing is different that you
can't
sort of have a consistent quantum description of both fields at once.
Yes, it's when it's in the lump is in two places, here and here, then its gravitational field, if you take the Einstein point of view of free fall, which gets rid of the gravity, and then you have a different vacuum. So for each of these two locations, you have a different quantum field theory. And that doesn't make any sense. You can't, you know... Go ahead with your standard procedures if you've got two different quantum field theories for the two lump positions.
Right.
So you're in trouble. So actually, I mean, technically you are in trouble. So what I try to do is say, well, how do you estimate the error or the uncertainty or whatever it is? And you do a little calculation. And you come to a measure of what this trouble is. How big is it? Mm-hmm. And it's like an uncertainty in the energy of the system. And then I say, well, it's a bit like an unstable particle. And what you find is that for an unstable nucleus, say, there is an energy uncertainty which is inversely related to its lifetime. And this is standard physics. And this inverse relationship is part of the Heisenberg uncertainty relationship where the time, you have time energy uncertainty. Okay, you might... It's sort of using it the other way around. So people say, if you know the lifetime of the system, what is the uncertainty in the energy? Now I'm saying that you have an uncertainty in the energy. What's the lifetime? What do I mean by lifetime?
Yeah. Well,
the
lifetime,
yes, is that it decays into one location or the other.
Now that's your proposal.
That's my
proposal. That's not
I should say that there is a Hungarian physicist called Diósi who had a very similar model before me. He didn't have this particular motivation, so it was more, well, here's a suggestion that you might have for how a superposed state might become one or the other by itself spontaneously. The point is that it's not somebody coming and looking at it, you see.
Nothing to do with observers.
That's right, nothing to do with observers. Or if it's anything, it's observing itself or something.
But do you think of this as a modification of conventional quantum mechanics or a completion of it? It's not there in the textbooks, right?
It's not in the textbooks. I think it's a modification.
Yeah, okay.
It's going to need a theory.
I
don't have a theory. It's going to need a revolution. I think of it as something like this. Newton's gravitational theory survived a long time. It worked beautifully. And, well, people started to see things like the motion of Mercury, which didn't quite agree with the theory, and maybe there was a little extra planet called Vulcan, or maybe there's some other explanation or so on. And then Einstein explained it by not modifying Newton's theory by putting another term in it or something, by looking at it completely differently.
Right. So I'm a partisan of Everettian quantum mechanics, of many worlds. I've wondered a little bit, although not, I haven't sat down and gone through the equations, but in Everett, we talk about wave functions branching because of decoherence, because a system interacts with an environment. Mm-hmm. And one way, you know, and there's a big challenge in quantum computing to prevent systems from acting, reacting with the environment so that you can maintain quantum coherence.
Yeah.
But one thing you can never escape is gravity. Right? So everything has a gravitational field. If you're in a superposition of two different places where your gravitational field would be different,
yeah.
I can at least imagine that there are virtual gravitons that are, you know, that in the particle physics language, that in the classical language we would say slightly different gravitational fields that could interact with the world and cause decoherence. And maybe just because gravity is mediated by massless particles, there's an inevitable branching of the wave function that leads to collapse in a way that is at least morally similar to what you're talking about.
I think if you do take an Everettian view, you've got to have something else like this to tell you what a world is, in a sense, because you want to be able to say it's this world or that world. And then you have to know what a world is. Is it some quantum mechanical mess of everything entangled with everything else? Or is it sort of singled out by having a well-defined geometric space-time structure? In other words, a well-defined gravitational right. field.
No, I very much agree. And I think that people who do foundations of quantum mechanics generally don't think too much about general relativity and space-time. Or if they are experts in it, they don't think that the two problems are related. But I do think that that's something people should take more seriously.
Yes. Well, I think, you see, there's a lot of talk about quantum gravity, you see. People say, well, we want to bring the two subjects together, these two great 20th century revolutions. That's fine. But they usually concentrate on how quantum mechanics might affect space-time structure or gravity.
Right.
And this is where you're looking at things at the tiny scale of 10 to the minus 33 centimeters and 10 to the minus 43 seconds and things like that, which are way off the range of experimental tests. So you might have to build an accelerator the size of the solar system or something like that in order to get the energies needed to explore this kind of level. But this is much more optimistic. This is the effect of gravity on quantum mechanics, not of quantum mechanics on gravity.
Right.
And this, or you could call it gravitized quantum mechanics, you see. And here, it's not bad at all. You're just looking at experiments which are on the verge of being done or being tried even now, and other experiments coming up which could well give maybe direct evidence of this. One of the latest ideas is using Bose-Einstein condensates. These are very, very quantum mechanical states, very, very cold, almost absolute zero, and you can play around with them in interesting ways, and you could put them in superpositions of two places at once and maybe see what happens. It's experimentally just about at the level that can be done.
And you've gone further than that. You've suggested it happens in our brains.
Yeah. Yes, well, that's...
For the audience, we should mention that in part you've done this in collaboration with Stuart Hameroff, who
yes,
is
indeed.
In the room right now. You can say hi, Stuart.
Yes, hi, Stuart.
He's
yes.
there.
Yes,
so true. Which came first, your consciousness thoughts, as it were, or your quantum mechanics thoughts, or when did they get together?
Well, you see, the quantum mechanics thoughts came first, but not that long before, because I mentioned these lecture courses I went to and the Dirac issue about where there is, seems to be a gap in our present understanding of quantum. He didn't put it like that, but that was what I felt. But then I also went to this course on mathematical logic. And I had been struck by, I'd had long conversations as an undergraduate with Ian Percival, who we used to discuss these things a lot. And this issue of mathematical logic, we had, you know, played around with logical systems and formal logic and so on. And then I'd vaguely heard about Gödel's theorem, which seemed to tell us that there are things in mathematics you couldn't prove.
Right.
And I didn't like that idea. So I went to the lecture course, which was very revealing. First of all, I learned about Turing machines, what modern computers are based on, if you like. So I knew what the notion of computation was, basically what a Turing machine can do, which is a very beautiful mathematical idea, and that there are certain things that are outside computation. So I was aware of this both things that you both things that you can compute and things which are outside computation or beyond universal computation. And then I learned about the Gödel theorem, and it was not that you things you can't see are true or false or something. It showed that if you have any logical system, let's say it's something the steps you could put them on a computer. So let's say they're computationally checkable. So you have a line of argument which is meant to be a proof of some mathematical statement. It could be like the Fermat's last theorem that Andrew Wiles famously proved, or it could be the Goldbach conjecture, which nobody has proved yet, if it's true. Or it could be simple statements like, if you add any two even numbers, you get another even number. So these are statements about an infinite number of things, which is rather a critical point. And how do you prove things like that? Now, is it according to following some specific logical system? Well, what Gödel shows, and Turing had a very much nicer way of doing it, but what Gödel showed is that given your system of proof procedures, and if you, by understanding what the system does, if you trust the results that it says are true, if you test it on a theorem, say, is Goldbach's checked, or whatever it is, suggest a thing, and if it comes out and says, yes, done, then you believe it. And you believe it because you've gone through all the proof procedures and the axioms involved, and you looked at the first one and say, yeah, that's okay, I trust that one. And the next one, you say, I'm not so, yeah, that's okay, yes, I see that one, and so on, until you're totally convinced that anything using those methods, if it says, yes, that's true, you believe it. Then what Gödel does is he shows a statement which absolutely clearly constructed from this set of rules, which is a statement of the same kind about numbers. And this statement, you can see, if you trust your system, if you're prepared to use your system to get truths, then you must trust this as being true as well.
Right.
So this statement is true on the basis of your same belief system as following the rules and things you come out with. So if you trust the system as giving you only truths, then you must believe the statement. Yet, at the same time, you demonstrate that it's not derivable by the rules. Now, how the hell do we know it's true?
If you can't prove it.
If you can't prove it that way.
That way, yeah.
Yet, you can see it's true by means of the same understandings that you have, that the procedures that you're accepting as giving you proofs. So that I was blown over by this when I saw it. And I thought, gosh, this means, as far as I can make out, that our abilities to understand things are not a computation, no matter what it is. Now,
because we can see truths that, you know, our mind, you get the result that our minds are not going through a proof procedure within some formal
system. That's right, yes. I mean, you can add that thing to the other one, if you like, and say, okay, here's my new proof procedure, but that's sort of cheating because that wasn't what you started with. And how did you know that other one was true when that your things you're supposed to know are true, the things that come from some algorithm in your head? And so what algorithm can that be if you can supersede it? Now, then I started thinking about, well, I don't like to think there's some mysterious, goodness knows what, comes from the fairies or something, which gives us insights. I think that our brains are constructed according to the same physical laws as everything else in the world. Maybe something subtle about the way it's organized. But then I thought, what about, I suppose it's Newtonian mechanics, well, you could put it on a computer. There's a little bit of a issue here because, strictly speaking, the laws that we know are based on the continuum, not discreteness.
Right.
But the sort of feeling is that if you had enough precision, you're going to get close enough. That needs a bit more exploration, but I think I'm not going to argue for that. I think that's the fact that it's a continuum as opposed to discreteness, I don't think is a big point. It was worth exploring that, but that's not what I thought. Okay, what about special relativity? Well, still calculations like Newton's things. What about Maxwell's equations, these continuous things, waves and so on? Well, yeah, same issue about the discreteness, but that's not probably the real point. You could put on a computer. And what about general relativity? Again, you could put on a computer. And we have a really good demonstration of this now with the LIGOs and these calculations.
You need to put it on a computer now. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, these calculations have come from really delicate understandings and calculations which have produced the signals that you expect to see from black hole encounters. So we can certainly apply these procedures to Einstein's general relativity. Now, what about quantum mechanics? Well, you can evolve the Schrodinger equation. Okay, it's difficult because you've got all these degrees of freedom which you have to keep track of. And it's, yeah, but you could still put that on a computer. But then I remember Dirac's piece of chalk, you see, and think, well, yeah, but, there's a gap. And if what we act upon when we're thinking and are understanding things, that's the main thing I concentrate on, our understanding, I would argue, is something which is not a computable process. And the only place I could see where there's a relevant gap in our physical understanding is in this measurement process or the collapse of the wave function.
Yeah. The random part of quantum mechanics.
The random part of quantum mechanics, that's right. So that's where we don't have a proper theory. So the argument is that whatever's going on in our heads, when it's producing conscious understandings, conscious feelings, conscious whatever, then that's involving this kind of gap in our understanding.
I mean, this is probably too much to ask in a brief period of time, but so how do we go from the randomness to some kind of understanding that goes beyond the merely algorithmic?
Well, the argument would be it's not really random.
Okay.
It looks random, but that's because that's the level we're at quantum mechanics. There's something deeper going on.
So there's a thumb on the scale of the collapse of the wave function to give us some kind of insight into things
Computers
can't get.
You see, it's the sort of opposite of some view that people have that the collapse of the wave function takes place when some conscious observer sees it.
Right.
So this is the opposite of that. It's not that our consciousness creates the collapse, it's the collapse that creates our consciousness. So the idea was that, and I wrote this book, The Emperor's New Mind, where I didn't know much about neurobiology and so on. I thought, well, I'll learn about it, and by the time I get to the end of the book, I'll see where there's a place that you could have quantum coherence at the level needed. I didn't. Wrote the book, and the publishers were, I just made up something at the end, which I didn't really believe in, and sent the book out, hoping that it would maybe stimulate some young people to do physics or maths or something. Most of the letters I got from old retired people. But then I got one letter, which was a little different from both of these, from our friend Stuart here. Stuart Hameroff told me, look, I think you might find these structures more relevant to your concerns than just neuron nerve propagation, which I thought didn't have a hope in hell of preserving coherence because it disturbs the environment You get these electric fields and stuff which churn everything around, and sure, how do you keep that quiet? And so Stuart, in his letter, described to me these little tubes. Nanoscale tubes. And I thought, what are these? I mean, I get lots of crazy letters from people. And is this another one? And I say, they look pretty real in the pictures. So I check up and say, yeah, just my ignorance was I didn't know about them. And so Stuart came off to Oxford, where I was at the time, and we got together and tried to make sense of what each other was talking about.
I mean, one thing that is a lurking question here, I did have David Chalmers on the podcast, and we talked about the hard problem versus the easy problem of consciousness.
Yeah.
From everything you just said, it sounds to me like what you're pointing at, or what Chalmers would call the easy problems of consciousness. And admittedly, no one thinks the easy problems are easy. Some people think the hard problem is impossible. Some people think it's easy, but
yes,
Everyone thinks the easy problems are hard. Do you think that this way of thinking about quantum wave function collapse in the brain would help us understand the process of experience, the first person subjective view?
Yeah, I mean, I had a short discussion with David Chalmers. I think after a talk I'd given, it was only about 10 seconds discussion. But see, he was complaining because I was saying basically, the view that Stuart and I have is that whenever one of these collapse processes takes place, that's where the state decides to be one or the other. When I say it decides, you see, that's sort of...
It gets decided, yes.
What is it, you see? But we call that is always accompanied by a moment of proto-consciousness. Now, you see, proto-consciousness, you think of that as the building blocks out of which consciousness is finally constructed. It doesn't have any purpose at that level, but it's the thing out of which consciousness is built. Now, David, I think, didn't like this. He thought it was still not a solution of the hard problem. Well, whether it is or not, depends right. on your point of view. But it's saying, okay, here is something which goes on in the physical world out of which consciousness is built. And so it's a point of view that experience... So you say there's a sort of very mini element of experience every time these reductions take place, but it's only proto-conscious. It doesn't relate it to anything else and doesn't have any purpose. It just does it.
And part of why you're here in Southern California and I get to talk to you is because you have a new institute. Is that right? The Penrose Institute. And
yes.
Consciousness is going to be one of the
That was certainly one of the big topics.
At.
Absolutely. No, I think... I mean, when I was approached by James Tagg originally, I mean, the idea was a bit scary and I wasn't sure about it, but it seems to me here is an opportunity to explore things where, you know, the mainstream is going in another direction. And one of the obvious places is with the consciousness issue. And Stuart and a few people take this point of view seriously, and here is a way of looking at it. It's not the mainstream, but it's a serious way of looking at the problem, which does have a chance, it seems to me, of yielding some real insights into what consciousness is.
So just tell us a little bit about the Penrose Institute. It's in San Diego, is that right?
Well, it's not anywhere.
It's a state of mind right now?
It's sort of spread out in various places. But San Diego is certainly... that was the place it was initially supposed to be based. I mean, maybe it is. It's not really based anywhere at the moment. It's kind of more of a concept rather than having a clear location. Which, you know, quantum mechanics, you can have things like
perfectly
that.
Perfectly compatible, yes, exactly. So yes. What's the mission statement of the Institute?
Well, let's see, I more or less made it up, but I can't remember it at the moment. But the idea is to explore ideas which are not mainstream,
right.
but they have to be things where they are experimentally testable. I wanted to make sure about that.
It's not a philosophy institute.
Well, that's right. And it's in danger. People might say, well, it's flaky. This is just some ideas of, you know... Who knows? But the idea is they have to be things where you could think... They needn't be immediately testable, but pretty soon. They've got to be really within the range of techniques. And so... But initially, these were on the consciousness thing or maybe things to do what creativity is or something. But I thought most of my work's on physics. I don't really do... I don't know much biology, so that's not really my main interests. And so I thought we need a strong side on the physics side, but which is exploring these things which are a little offbeat in the sense of not too many people do it. So things like the collapse of the wave function was mm-hmm. an important one. And I asked Yvette Fuentes, who's somebody I knew who works on unconventional approaches to gravitational wave detection, and that's what I knew about. So you use Bose-Einstein condensates, which is completely on a different scale from LIGO. But it struck me that there's a lot of promise in that idea because these Bose-Einstein condensates are the most quantum mechanical thing you can think of, more or less, and they're practically absolute zero. So you're looking at things which are can be really isolated from disturbance from the outside. And not only... I had long discussions with her also about how you might use these things for the collapse of the wave function.
Right.
So this is actually the major project. It's being done in Nottingham in England at the moment because that's where her post... She was in Vienna originally when I was getting her interested in this. And so she has a team of people working in Nottingham. And one of the projects, the main project they're really concerned with is looking at these Bose-Einstein condensates and whether you can see whether the collapse of the wave function takes place in a measurable way, and which is... objective, not something that depends on somebody looking at it. And it really, the system itself does this or that in a time scale which is consistent with the sort of proposal that I was putting forward.
Well, you know, as a scientist, it's always good to be correct to say things that are true, but also, which you certainly have done, but it's also something to be said when you're able to inspire and provoke people into doing interesting things and looking into things in slightly new ways.
That's very much the case, yes. And the hope is, of course, yes, to get other people who might be interested in exploring some of these ideas and taking them seriously. And
you've gotten a lot of things named after you along the way, which is pretty good, too.
Yeah, there are a few of those, yes.
All right. Roger Penrose, it's been a great pleasure. Thanks so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you. Great pleasure.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.